Welcome to EAN Cast, your weekly source for education, research, and updates from the European Academy of Neurology.
Welcome to EAN Cast, weekly neurology. My name is Justyna Paprocka, and I'm the head of the Pediatric Neurology Department at the Medical University of Silesia in Katowice, Poland. I'm also a member of EAN Scientific Committee. The topic today is interpreting emergency EEG in suspected non-convulsive status epilepticus. My guests today are very well-known epilepsy experts. At the beginning, I would like to introduce Professor Stefan Rüegg, a neurologist specialized in epileptology, neurointensive care, and autoimmune encephalitis, and the head of the Epilepsy and Sleep Unit at the University Hospital of Basel in Switzerland. And the second guest is Professor Markus Leitinger, a neurologist, neurointensivist, a neurophysiologist, head of the EEG lab at Salzburg University Hospital, Christian Doppler University Hospital. Dear guests, thank you for your joining us today. My first question is about the prevalence of non-convulsive status of epilepticus. First, let me ask Professor Rüegg.
There's not an exact number about that, but we estimate that non-convulsive status epilepticus encompasses about 40% of all status epilepticus, and status epilepticus is about 9 to 15 cases per 10,000. It's a rough estimate because you don't have exact data, especially about the non-convulsive status epilepticus, because you can only difficultly diagnose it. So perhaps Markus has done a study on the epidemiology in his city. I think he has more precise data.
Yeah, thank you, Stefan. This is a quite interesting thing, and thank you for pointing out the prevalence as it appears in the emergency department. We have, in fact, done a study, and a population-based study, where we could focus on the whole encatchment area of our hospital. And when the total number of status epilepticus is about 36 per 100,000 adults, it's about the 12 per 100,000 are non-convulsive status, whereas the 24 per 100,000 is prominent motor phenomena. But I totally agree with you, Stefan, because when we did this study in was from 2010 to 2015, then the NCC criteria, the diagnostic criteria, were introduced in 2013. And what we could see was an increase exactly in that year, that when you provide adequate criteria, then people dare to say, yes, this is non-convulsive status. And this happens, so when you have the availability of criteria fosters the diagnosis and gives clinicians a safe feeling to do this.
Yes, I can only add then to the difficulties, not only the criteria, but we need essentially the EEG, and we looked even that not only the EEG is necessary, but that you have enough time to record with the EEG to diagnose the non-convulsive status epilepticus. And we did a small study in our hospital more than almost 15 years ago, where we could show that the use of longer recordings markedly increased the detection rate of non-convulsive status epilepticus.
Yeah, that's fine. So in our hospital, we tried to accentuate the use of continuous EEG, which is now in a rather satisfying progress. And the continuous EEG, let's say 24 hours, is very valuable in this detection of non-convulsive seizures. There is another point I would like to mention is the two helps to be score. That means when you have 1 hour recording, then there are a few features with which you can calculate the total score, and this helps you to estimate the probability of occurrence of seizures or status in the next 24 hours. What do you think about this?
No, that's absolutely helpful score of our colleagues established, and we use it too to look whether how is the probability of catching a non-convulsive status epilepticus. Perhaps you can say, what is the content of the help to be, which perhaps you can shortly mention for those that are not so familiar with the, or we look and after and tell in a later moment. So,
yeah, thank you for giving me the opportunity to say this. So first of all, it's very helpful that this score can be entered online. That means if you just enter 2 as a number, helps, then again 2 as a number and B and the word score, then you are immediately connected to an automated calculator which provides you with the essential opportunities. Just to give you a short idea of what is asked there, it's first brief potentially ectorhythmic discharges, that is birds. You know that there are potential birds and definite birds according to ACNS. And you can obtain 2 points here. So this is a very important criterion. Then it's the presence of lateral sporadic discharges, lateral rhythmic delta activity, or bilateral independent periodic discharges, which lead to 1 point. Another point you can earn with prior seizures or sporadic epileptiform discharges or a frequency of more than 2 hertz of any periodic or rhythmic pattern. You know that the American Clinical Neurophysiology Society, that is ACNS criteria, also provide criteria for the plus features, like plus F, the fast frequencies, or plus R, which is rhythmic activity, and or plus S with rhythmic delta activities with superimposed shockwaves. So this group also earns 1 extra point. And for example, if you have just 1 point, then you have 2 helps to be scored of 1 point, which means that you have a 12% risk of a seizure, and the recommended length of additional CEG monitoring is 12 hours. So this score helps us a lot to gauge the resources and to decide who should be recorded with a continuous EEG.
Exactly. And I think we should now underscore a little bit, as I note a little bit in my framework, that the diagnosis of non-convulsive status epilepticus can be done affirmatively only by having an EEG recording. Because clinically, even after 35 years looking at these people, you can really sometimes being very convinced that must be non-convulsive status epilepticus. So you put on the recording and you see only severe encephalopathy. And I think these two entities, the non-convulsive status epilepticus and encephalopathy, they are really a continuum with a large gray land in between, where the expertise of the EEG reader is still absolutely necessary to compare clinical signs with the electroencephalographic traces or patterns.
Stefan, there is a very practical issue I would like to discuss with you. So, for example, we hook up or we provide a montage to a patient, and then we make the recording. We find a very abnormal EEG. That means there is a slowing in background, maybe some discontinuity even, and there are some periodic patterns. And we are aware that this pattern might be on the ictal-interictal continuum. So we think that it is quite helpful to do an intravenous anti-seizure medication trial because this is, if you do it adequately, you get really an idea of whether this pattern might respond or might not respond. What is your experience with this approach?
Yes, that's a very good approach. There are two things also I would share with my audience. The first thing is the usual emergency treatment of suspected status epilepticus, or especially of established status epilepticus, is the first line benzodiazepine. And Unfortunately, some of the patterns that may indicate an encephalopathy also reacts to the benzodiazepine. This is the former called triphasic waves. Now it's generalized periodic discharges with triphasic morphology. But if you give them a trial with the benzodiazepine, both epileptiform discharges and these GPDs with triphasic morphology disappear. And for that reason, we sometimes start with a really big shot of levetiracetam, because that's a pure or more pure anti-seizure medication, also very quickly acting, and looking how the trace reacts to that, because that would not be a benzodiazepine effect, but really an anti-seizure medication effect.
That's a very, very important point. Thank you for bringing this up. And I love to say this, I love to hear that you use this approach as well, because, you know, there was a small group who asked themselves how to approach these patients with an IV ASM trial. And we really made a table or a diagram which allows for officially to start with anti-seizure medication in this IV diagnostic ASM trial, especially in patients who have already a decreased level of consciousness, where you assume that this further decreases when you apply or administer benzodiazepines, or in a patient group where people have respiratory suppression, then you assume that this even worsens when you give benzodiazepines right now. So you may start with ASM, but be careful. It's only for this diagnostic, that's diagnostic, I have to say twice, diagnostic IV ASM trial, and not for purely status epilepticus treatment, not for status treatment, but for diagnostic trial.
Absolutely. That's a very, very important point, because in the last 10 years, we saw that the guidelines are absolutely clear how to treat step-by-step status epilepticus, and there are so much violations that the benzodiazepines are not given or too late, or they are only in second place and they are too low dosed. Of course, if a patient is already in critical state with his respiratory functions, then it would be quite challenging to administer benzodiazepines. But on the other hand, benzodiazepines in almost every larger study are underdosed because we fear that respiratory suppression. And the most of the studies show that the sufficient use of sufficient dosed use of benzodiazepines save lives. And in the very early trial from Eldridge with the benzodiazepine out hospital, lorazepam, the respiratory problems were bigger in the group which received placebo than in the group that received 8 milligrams of lorazepam. So I think that's also another point to keep in mind with the benzodiazepine on the benzodiazepine trial. But as a trial for non-convulsive status epilepticus, I think that's an interesting thing to do without benzodiazepine.
Yeah, that's. Thank you for pointing this out. Because people really are afraid of giving too much, but the patient may even get worse without an efficient and efficacious treatment. That's a great message. So great take-home message. Please do not underdose benzodiazepines in case of status treatment. Do you have, Stefan, do you have a pocket card in use in your hospital?
It's not a pocket card, it's worse. It's a leaflet or a booklet, a very small booklet that fits the pocket of our assistants. We did it with another hospital together, and it's quite used. And there are also blind copies around in Switzerland and even in southern Germany of this little booklet where we say a little bit how we proceed with diagnosing and especially with treating the status epilepticus, because some guideline or some guidance, because it's not a guideline, it's a guidance for young doctors coming to neurology and doing first calls. And so that's important to have. Yeah.
Have you considered to publish this small book in order to provide?
No, because it's a little bit, say, experience-based or eminence-based. It's really not evidence-based. And it was quite tricky to have it here around in Switzerland without, say, it's as good, as well evidence-based as possible. But everyone can have the PDF of that, and we should really, really revise it because it's from 2019. And so, But I think we should a little bit return to the electrophysiology, because I think the podcast is rather on diagnosing, on EEG, when I remember right the title of our podcast, and not, say, the treatment of status epilepticus, which both of us like to discuss about.
Oh, Stefan, just to tell you that we provide a pocket card, not about treatment, but about the criteria in EEG reading. And this one has been published recently in Epileptic Disorders. It is not, maybe not a big deal, but I think those who want to use it can use it. It's among the supplemental material. It's the how to diagnose status epilepticus. And just, it's not something famous or something like this, but for the beginners, it might be helpful. And if you could have a look at it and provide me feedback at some time, I would be very happy. Because this leads us exactly to the point. We have the criteria. Who of both of us should give the listener, the audience, a short overview about the criteria? Would you be so kind?
Oh, you correct me if I'm incorrect, because Marcus Leiting, it was really he published that in Lancet Neurology, one of the most famous paper in epileptology in the last 10 years. So it's the so-called Salzburg criteria, because we met at the colloquium and we found that the diagnostic, there's some aporia and we do not well with diagnosing, and criteria, as Marcus mentioned earlier, would be very, very helpful. And then this group of experts established these so-called Salzburg criteria, and Marcus validated that in an internal and external cohort. So that's a very important thing. It's a flow chart at the end. And it starts always with the clinical suspicion of a non-convulsive status epilepticus. And if you have clear epileptiform discharges and they have a frequency above the 2.5 hertz, that's an established, or that the diagnosis of non-convulsive status epilepticus can be made. If the frequency is below of this 2.5 cycles per second or hertz per second, then there is a lot of criteria. You can look at them, and if they are present or not present, that leads you to either to the non-convulsive status epilepticus or to the possible non-convulsive status epilepticus, or that excludes or makes it very unlikely that you have non-convulsive status epilepticus. And this, there are four criteria when you're below this 2.5 frequency of epileptic discharges per second, then we mentioned already or discussed for a long time the IVIED trial. So you try an intravenous anti-seizure medication and look if there is a response. And the best or the clearest response is not only that the EEG normalizes or speeds up or the discharges disappear, but also that the patient clinically improves. Because that's the fascinating on non-convulsive status epilepticus. You have a likely comatose or non-responding patient. You give him something what we call a somnifere, this benzodiazepine, and the patient awakes. It's like a paradoxical reaction. So that makes you very, very confident that the patient who awakes after the giving or having administered benzodiazepines, it must be, and that's clearly status epilepticus. There is no other disease that patients awake upon the administration of benzodiazepines. Then if you see in a longer recording of in the next 10, 20 minutes, you see a spatiotemporal evolution that there you have a spread of epileptic discharges to other brain regions. You have a, say, also an increase you have a decrease in frequency and what you call a seizure, then it would be also a very pointing that this is non-convulsive status epilepticus, because status epilepticus is not only a permanent epileptiform discharges, but also short seizures. Within them, the patient does not recur to a normal state. So a series of short seizures very close together also makes the diagnosis of a non-convulsive and also of a convulsive status epilepticus. Then if you see subtle ictal clinical phenomena on a patient, some twitching with the eyes or so, that can be correlated also a little bit with the EEG. That also points to the presence of a non-convulsive status epilepticus. However, when you have only fluctuations a little bit in frequency of your waves and you don't have clear, really discharges, and you have no evolution, say, really a spatial expansion of your activity, or you don't have really frequency changes that are clearly definite, then that would not fulfill the criteria for definitive non-convulsive status epilepticus, but for possible. And then you can look whether you do then an IED ISM trial and looking whether he reacts or not. If it reacts clinically and electroencephalographically, then it would also be a non-convulsive status epilepticus. If there's no reaction on the trial with an IV anti-seizure medication, then it remains a possible non-convulsive status epilepticus. And if you have a very static pattern which is sometimes a little bit rhythmic, but not really rhythmic, no evolution, no spatial, neither temporal evolution, then this is only encephalopathy and this is not non-convulsive status epilepticus. I hope I've summarized a little bit the criteria.
Oh, that's fantastic. Really, thank you so much for this. I just have a question, because when I was young,
still young.
No, thank you so much. I was a bit confused by the term possible status, really. However, I think that the ACNS approach is very helpful. They say that possible status is something like ictal integral continuum, which means you have to do something to find out. So possible doesn't mean it's the result of something, but it's the start of giving a diagnostic IV ASM trial. So do something when there is something in doubt or something possible. So the final result should be, ideally, yes or no. But I understand that possible status means it's on a continuum where you do not know exactly right from the beginning what this pattern means. Do you see it in a similar way or totally differently?
No, absolutely. And possible status epilepticus is something to me that is moving or can move. It's nothing static. So either it turns back to a pure encephalopathy, and then I think time is important also in possible status epilepticus. This is not saying 1 second of an EEG and then you say it's possible status epilepticus, but you have a pattern over time, say the next 10 minutes. If nothing happens, it remains. If some birds came up or some ictal, especially temporal evolution, then it turns towards definitive non-convulsive status epilepticus, or it turns to encephalopathy. Possible is quite an unstable or transient state of something, because you cannot be, I think, 72 hours in possible status epilepticus. So possible status epilepticus needs a decision, and the decision can be administer an IV ASM and looking if it reacts or not, and then this pushes you out from possible to encephalopathy. If the patient reacts, then it pushes to NCSE. I think also the ictal continuum is this gray land or this epileptic gray land between encephalopathy and status epilepticus.
Oh, that's fantastic. That's very brilliant wording and descriptions. Regarding the seizures, I was asked, for example, if you have one seizure pattern, one evolution pattern in 24 hours, is that status? And I think that the ACNS gave a clear answer. So it should be above 20% of the recording. So this 20% are right, a good sensitivity specificity approach where you really are confident with being on the right track, not overestimating, but also not underestimating. What do you think, please?
Yes, that's important, but sometimes practically it can be challenging to determine the 20% with certainty. Of course, if it's 50 or 60%, you are not in doubt, and then you will think at least it's status epilepticus because it's so frequent. But being around, say, with the 20% to discriminate between 15 and 25, we use then persistent looking to if you can see a pattern, whether that is about a fifth of the recording that is in the ictal state. So that's maybe helpful. To use these technical helps of semi-automated EEG analysis. Also, they cannot diagnose, to my opinion, non-convulsive status epilepticus because they are really not fit enough to look at the artifacts, and many, many patterns are, I think, not recognized by these softwares. Yeah.
Great. There was just one more important point I would like to make is that when we teach our newcomers at our department, then we really force them to have a check of cerebral imaging and laboratory and also drug levels, let's say lithium or so, to integrate all medical and paramedical data to interpret the EEG. You know, when you have a patient in acute renal failure or severe hepatic failure, then patterns may arise that are really on the gray zone between status and encephalopathy. However, both acute renal failure and others may cause a status. So, but we are more reluctant if we have a true metabolic explanation for a specific EEG pattern, we maybe go a step back, keep it all the picture, and we also give IV diagnostic IV ASM trial, but we are more reluctant to say, well, this is aggressive status if the underlying etiology may by itself explain the EEG pattern. Is that a useful approach? What do you think?
Yes, as I said, I think the whole picture is always the patient, his paraclinical values, say imaging and lab values, and you have to take in account, and that makes it so difficult. If you have a comatose patient with severe organ or multi-organ failure, and then comes up, is this status epilepticus? That can be really, really challenging, because if the patient, for example, is severely obtunded by high uremia or high ammonia, and then he closes his eyes, you cannot say he opens the eyes and then it's clear status and closed is not status. You can't absolutely say that, but it's usually true in almost otherwise healthy patients going into status epilepticus. So you have really to be very, very careful what is the egg and what is the chicken. So also a little bit what causes what. And sometimes it can be very, very difficult. And at the end, I think we try to treat both of them. Say if you have renal failure, you will be really looking that the values are that you have hemodialysis or something like that, and you give trial of anti-seizure medication to look whether that works and the patient improves.
Very well. I would like to address one point. That means if we have to give a recommendation to our young colleagues, what is the literature that we could start on? So maybe each of us gives one literature recommendation. My one is my personal one, but maybe you start. But
no, yours. It's yours.
So I would like to say, if you have only one flight or one travel by train, and also only one paper, take the ACNS criteria 2021 to start with, because there is so much about epileptiform discharges. It's about critical care, e.g. terminology. If you have gone through this paper with the many, many pictures you can see there, it's really a good starting point. What do you think?
Absolutely. It's the same thing. The first day in the EEG, they get a little small book of papers that they have to read on. One is the ACNS classification. The other one is the Salzburg criteria, of course, because that's very, very an important thing to diagnose the most difficult EEG patterns, I think, or the EEG condition, the non-convulsive status epilepticus. So that's really essential papers. Then also the help to be score. It's a very well written paper because it's very helpful, very practical, and very easy to administer. So I think that's my trios or my trilogy of papers that the residents should read when they start the EEG, because in our rotation they go also on the ICU, and they like to do that because it's a very fascinating world, I think, for neurologists and for neurophysiologists to be there with these very special patients and the very special patterns of EEGs you can see there.
That brings into my mind that also patients after cardiac arrest might benefit from a clear EEG diagnosis. So they have found in the TELSTAR trial that patterns that are not just periodic, but those who might fulfill these criteria might, in a subgroup analysis and so on, that they might benefit at the end of the day. So I think this is an open issue. And just to tell you that the EEG in the post-hypoxic patients, I've done a work together with Pier De Stefano, a systematic review of myoclonus, and there we found out that in a collective with an existing well-responding background, it's the background that drives the outcome and not so much the presence of myoclonic phenomena. And it could be, it was a subgroup of 20% CPC 1 or 2, which is quite good, and in this subgroup, right? And Pier and Nicola Gaspar have done another work together, and they could prove this in their cohort in up to 25%. So EEG really makes sense. Also, it's better to do more EEG than less when you can interpret it and give it a chance to interpret it. It's also on non-neurological ICUs. Let's say a medical ICU where patients after cardiac arrest are treated and cared for. So also there, the EEG has its well-established place, I think.
Absolutely. Also, to my opinion, and it's not only a diagnostic tool, it's also a prognostic tool, or can serve or partly assist in doing a neuroprognostication, and the exact handling and knowing the pattern on, so the evolution that patients after post-anoxic cardiac encephalopathy after cardiac arrest have, that's very important for people working on the neuro or on the ICU. And what is also very important is that the EEG has to be interpreted very carefully in the first 8 hours after the cardiac arrest, because there is very old data, but sound data, that there can be even a flatline EEG, and people can really recover because the first 6-8 hours the brain is really in turmoil, and after between 8 and 24 hours, you get really already very decisive patterns and also some prognostic information. And then you look together with the other modalities, how will be the prognosis of the patient after cardiac arrest?
Stefan, I think we should wrap up. Maybe each of us says 2 to 3 points or more, as you like. Just the take-home message. What is the most important thing that people should remember of our dialogue now, or a recommendation, or whatever you like? So just say, what is the final summary of our talk?
Okay, if you do EEG on an ICU or do looking at non-convulsive status epilepticus, read the ACNS paper to see all the patterns you can have with big and good examples. That will help you a lot.
Thank you. So please remember there are 4 criteria. Epileptiform discharges more than 2.5 hertz or 25 per 10 seconds per screen usually, or epoch as we say. Clear clinical spatiotemporal evolution. Both of them are called electrographic status. And in the group of electroclinical status, we have a time-locked clinical correlate. That means, for example, a jerk, but it can also non-motor phenomenon, like ictal blinking of the eyes. You see light flashes. And the second one is EEG and clinical response due to a diagnostic IBA-ASM trial. One word, be careful, the clinical response may officially occur up to 24 hours after the IBA-ASM administration. That means maybe you have to wait a few hours or ask the next day. This is also relevant, not to say it's not in the first 5 seconds, we can take this.
Dear guest, okay, thank you for this fantastic discussion and thank you for your presence today. Thank you.
Thank you, Stefan. It was a
great pleasure. Thank you, Markus. It was a great pleasure, too. Greetings to Salzburg.
Greetings to Basel.
Okay.
Greetings to Holland. Bye.
This has been EAN Cast Weekly Neurology. Thank you for listening. Be sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your preferred podcatcher for weekly updates from the European Academy of Neurology. You can also listen to this and all of our previous episodes on the EAN campus to gain points and become an EAN expert in any of our 29 neurological specialties. Simply become an EAN individual member to gain access. For more information, visit ean.org/membership. That's ean.org/membership. Thanks for listening. EAN Cast Weekly Neurology is your unbiased and independent source for educational and research-related neurological content. Although all content is provided by experts in their field, it should not be considered official medical advice.